actually.
Oh, okay.
Open the Joint Committee on Legislative Audits, Information Management and Technology for December 9th, 2014. We have a pretty normal agenda before us. I've had no request to actually change the order of the agenda, so we'll just proceed with the agenda as stated. The first item on the agenda is an informational, they're all informational meetings, but the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, General Review of Veteran Services, the audit report. Do you want to give a lead-in, and then we'll have the people come up from Secretary of State's audits, and I think there's probably someone here from the Department of Veterans Affairs also.
Yes, all three.
Chair Dillon, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting us to talk about this report that we produced. My name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division. With me on my right is Elliot Shuford. He's a staff member who is responsible for this review of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And before I turn it over to him, I'd like to provide a little bit of context about what this report is. In every audit effort that we start, we look at all of the key program areas of an agency that are directly related to its mission and look for areas where we think we can find improvement. So we really kind of go through and do a scan of the whole organization, and at the end of that, we decide which area we think might have opportunities for improvement or problem areas that we could tackle as auditors. Once we've agreed upon that area, then we apply government audit standards and go through our field work and our report writing phase. In this case, when we got into the Department of Veterans Affairs, we saw substantial changes underway. And for us to go in there and look at past practices that would no longer necessarily be the case in the future was not necessarily the best use of our audit resources, because we would be making recommendations to change things that they were already changing. So we saw a substantial amount of change related to the strategic plan going on in this agency, but we felt like, because for a variety of reasons, a lot of attention on federal veterans affairs, but also the fact that this is a critical service for Oregon's veterans, we wanted to at least report on what we saw. And we also saw some what we'd call considerations. They aren't necessarily full recommendations. We don't want them to get in the way of the initiatives that the agency has put forward, but we think they might be other things that they can consider as they go forward. So this is not what I would call a full audit. It's a look at an organization that's undergoing considerable change, and to that degree, we don't want to get in the way of that either. We think it's important to encourage change and improvement in agencies. So this is kind of a look at the agency as it's undergoing the change, and we can certainly come back in the future and look at the progress it's made on its initiatives and even issue an audit and recommendations at that point. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Elliot Shuford.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to discuss the general management review of Veterans Affairs Department. My name is Elliot Shuford. I'm a performance auditor with the Secretary of State Audits Division. And as Gary mentioned, we initially started a multi-agency review of the coordination of veteran services in Oregon. As part of that review, we talked to a lot of community members, community activists, and advocates and stakeholders of the department. And we actually heard a lot of positive feedback about ODVA. And that's not something that we always hear about state agencies when we talk to all the community partners. But in this case, there was a lot of positive feedback. So we decided, as Gary mentioned, not to do a full audit at this time, but we did issue this report, which does have some considerations for the department. It identifies some areas that we believe that the agency may consider as they refine and implement their strategic plan, which I know Director Cameron is going to talk about. Generally, those considerations include ways that the department can strengthen the oversight of county veteran service officers, better identify veterans and conduct outreach, continue to develop key partnerships with other state agencies and service providers, and then ways to improve and expand the training that's offered by the department. So ODVA plays a key role for veterans, coordinating services for veterans here in Oregon. A large component of that is the department's oversight of the CVSO, or the County Veteran Service Officer Program. ODVA and the state ultimately depends on CVSOs to help veterans access their federal benefits. It's a key function. We recognize that the department is focusing on strengthening its relationships with CVSOs. It's worth noting that CVSOs are county employees, so oversight over those individuals can be difficult. Still, our report points out a few ways that the department could consider strengthening that oversight. They include developing clear performance standards for CVSOs, and the department may also wish to consider communicating those standards to those whom CVSOs report. It's worth noting that that varies considerably from county to county. In some counties, they may report directly to county elected leadership, whereas in another county, the CVSO may report to someone within a health department. So there's wide variability throughout the state. The department may also wish to develop new or refine existing reporting expectations and requirements for those CVSOs. The federal VA data shows that relatively low percentages of Oregon veterans are accessing or maximizing their federal benefits. This is the same as is the case in other states. The identification of veterans is a key to being able to ensure that the state is able to benefit or to market those benefits and to reach out to veterans. The report notes a couple of areas that could be strengthened to help expand that identification and outreach to veterans, which involve other state agencies. We looked at several state applications, such as TANF and SNAP and a number of other applications, and to try to determine what questions are they asking with respect to military service status. And we found pretty wide variability in terms of what those applications ask. On one application, it's, is anyone in your household a veteran? And then on another one, it might be a line for VA income. And then we also heard that many people who would likely qualify for veterans benefits don't necessarily identify themselves as a veteran. So for instance, people who served in active duty but may not have served in combat, they may not think of themselves as a veteran, even though they may qualify for a range of different benefits. So ODVA may wish to consider partnering with state agencies to ensure that those widely used state applications contain whatever the gold standard question is to ask about military status, so that those individuals can be identified later and potentially have some referral information sent to them. Some agencies per legislation are asking members of the public about military service and sharing that referral information with ODVA. In one case, we noted that it may not be possible for ODVA to share that information directly with CVSOs. So ODVA might again consider partnering to ensure that the information sharing among agencies is effective and streamlined. Related to information sharing, ODVA is working on its ability to collect and analyze data in general. Another tool for identifying veterans is the Public Assistance Reporting Information System, or PARIS. This program provides states with matched data showing those who are receiving public assistance who are also veterans. Some states have robust PARIS programs, which seem to have been quite successful in helping veterans ensure that they're maximizing their federal VA benefits. In some cases, that means that those veterans are able to move back from certain state-funded programs, and then those state funds are then available to help others in those same state programs. Here in Oregon, DHS is starting a pilot project, or at least it was during the summer, starting a pilot project to work with some of the PARIS data. Our report says that ODVA could consider developing a partnership with DHS and OHA to ensure that the PARIS data management will indeed ensure that veterans are maximizing their federal benefits. The department has identified...
Would you prefer we hold questions until later, sir?
Why don't we have you complete then questions for the Secretary of State, and then we'll go to the Department of Veterans Affairs and then have questions.
Perfect.
That'll work.
Thanks.
Yeah. I think he's almost finished, actually.
Yeah. I can be, Chair.
There's a message from you in there.
I think that was a hint. I'll, twice as fast now. No, the department has identified the use of partnerships as a key strategy in their strategic framework, which aligns with several of the considerations that we outlined in the report. The department may wish to strengthen existing relationships, or in some cases may see the need to develop new ones. For instance, regarding higher education, ODVA may consider partnering with Oregon's colleges and universities to assist with outreach and help recruit veteran students and ensure their success. Continuing to develop or strengthening ODVA's partnerships may also help with marketing veteran veteran employment information, which is something that the department actually does quite a bit, and it may also help ensure awareness of programs that are aimed at those who are homeless and veterans or at risk of becoming so. Finally, training was another area for the department's consideration. In addition to helping veterans file and access federal benefits, ODVA told us that CVSOs play an important role in providing referral services so that veterans can access other important services in their communities. ODVA's current CVSO training and certification for CVSOs doesn't actually include referral work as part of those training materials, and so the department may wish to consider adding the referral process as part of their training and certification. And we heard differing views among community partners and CVSOs about how veterans who receive state assistance on programs such as Medicaid would be affected if they then pursue federal VA benefits. From some healthcare workers and social workers, we heard one thing, and from CVSOs, we might hear another thing. And so we thought that ODVA could consider clarifying how state and federal VA benefits affect one another and then make that part of training for CVSOs. It's worth noting that there are community partners and caseworkers who may benefit from such training as well. In closing, as ODVA is refining and implementing its strategic framework, we really appreciated the opportunity to provide some insight into some areas that could help them as they're implementing that strategic plan. With that, I thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions I can.
Representative Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the review and for all of that info, and I understand that the timing made it difficult to, or it had forced a certain choice upon you that most audits don't involve. But I've been aware of the Paris program for a while and had several conversations with colleagues here, with people in Washington County, with people from the state of Washington who are very much involved in it. You mentioned that some states have saved significant resources and also provided better or enabled some of their veterans to obtain federal benefits at higher levels that they were unaware that they qualified for. Washington has, I believe, been one state that has been very effective in that regard. And I wonder what weight you are suggesting that our Veterans Affairs Department pursue this pilot and beyond, because conversations I had with folks at the county level really led me to believe that there were significant savings for the state and significant benefits for our veteran population here.
Chair Devlin, Representative Harker, so the way that Washington State has worked, and Washington State is kind of the lead example of implementing Paris, the state agency that is in charge of the Paris data is usually the Human Services Agency. That's the one that sort of owns the data, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term. I should note, at the local level here in Oregon, there are in some cases seem to be a really good matchup between the local caseworkers and the CVSOs, where they're sharing referrals pretty freely, and there doesn't really seem to be an issue, because it's, you know, somebody's not going to get onto a Medicaid program if they're eligible for VA benefits in the first place. The DHS pilot that the materials that we reviewed during the summer for the DHS pilot that's happening now is seems to be fairly focused on income verification for DHS programs to ensure Medicaid compliance. Now, in the range of things that are possible with the Paris data, with Washington State being a comparison, there are probably good opportunities to make sure that veterans are getting the benefits that they're entitled, and to ensure that they don't accidentally wind up in a program that could be jeopardized if they were to get federal VA benefits later. Just to put it in context, Washington State reports, and I think it's a pretty solid financial number, that it's between $3 and $4 million a year that they're reaping in savings from their general fund by pursuing the Paris program vigorously. There, it's a careful partnership between the Human Services Agency and the State Department of Veterans Affairs. It really is. It has to be a partnership with both sides for it to work. It can't just be one agency, because both of those sides have to be working in concert together. And that's why we highlighted that in the report. It's a partnership which represents a tremendous opportunity.
Okay. Thank you for the response and also for highlighting it. Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, a proud Marine and director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. It's great to have you all back in the building and to provide an update today. And I will be honest, most of my fellow agency directors, when they see Gary and Sharon and the rest of the audit team and Elliot here coming down the hall or across the mall, they probably head the other way so as to not to have an audit or a review. But we looked at it as a real opportunity. We've had a lot of turnover just naturally as an agency over the last year and a half that I've been director. Some 30% of our total staff, probably seven of our nine key managers, are either new to their seat or new to the agency. So both capturing that heart and soul and expertise of staff that's leaving and also bringing on those fresh eyes to bring a fresh look at our work. So it has been very helpful. I want to thank the Secretary of State from the top and then Gary on down through his audits team for their review. I would hate to see what a full audit is, though, because they spent a lot of time both with our team members, and it felt like Elliot was a veteran himself going to more military veterans events and linking to our community partners. I'm going to blast through a few slides that gives you some background on our strategic approach at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and then happy to take any questions. We are billing this as a new cadence, growing out of that military veterans culture. Cadence is when you get folks in step, whether on that march or on that run. It's interesting, one person will come out and call that cadence and pop back in, someone else will come out. So we are that leadership role in partnership with the Oregon National Guard and the Adjutant General and his team for those efforts for military and veterans, but it is that broader public-private partnership that make it work for our veterans. So we're going to be 70 years old as an agency, stood up next year in 2015, stood up after World War II, but for the first time in history serving four generations across five major wars. Just a huge breadth of a population for us. One out of every 10 Oregonians is a veteran, over 320,000 veterans across the state. And a very diverse bunch. So we hear a lot about the most recent generation, my generation, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, but still only 6.6%. Still a huge contingent, much older generation of our World War II in Korea, often the same generation given how close those wars were, but quickly losing those older veterans. Vietnam veterans still 37%, the largest contingent of our population. A quarter served in peacetime and on humanitarian missions around the world, and then the Gulf War at 15%. But just a very diverse group, both across the eras and all ages, but also 9% of women, 9% of our veterans population are women and the fastest growing demographic for veterans populations, 8% minorities, and we always call out 1% of our tribal warriors and tribal veterans served at a higher per capita rate than any other community. And across that broad and diverse population, a huge breadth of policy and issue areas, just like all of our citizens, across healthcare, mental health, economic opportunity, employment, education, housing, and emergency services. So really just a, and those kind of span across, not education throughout, but many of them have challenges and issues. We always say that our veterans and military families are strengthened by their service, but it's not a surprise given their service that they can also face challenges when they reintegrate back home. And our big challenge, as the Secretary of State review called out, 3 out of 10 Oregon veterans have accessed what are largely their federal VA benefits. The federal VA, $160 billion annual budget behemoth, both across the healthcare, the education, disability pension benefits. But only about 3 in 10 Oregon veterans tapping those benefits. And it's not through lack of work. We are, you know, over 71,000 claims submitted under ODVA's power of attorney in partnership with the counties for fiscal year 13-14. 16,000 of those were new claims for veterans. We are a top 10 state for veteran services, but it is a huge opportunity for us moving forward, not just to access more of those federal VA dollars and draw those down for our the veterans and the economic impact, but also to save on those safety net services at the state and local level through efforts like the Paris program. This is a diagram of the system. So a veteran on the ground in a local community across Oregon has an issue and files a disability and pension claim. Our county veteran service, largely the county veteran service officers, we also have a few at the statewide level focused on Marion and Polk County, but largely the 34 counties that have VSOs, they take on that power of attorney and submit that claim on behalf of the veteran up through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We are in charge of their training, the certification. We review the claims. We also work on the appellate nature, very much a legal claims process through the federal VA. Comes up through the ODVA and then to the federal VA with their regional office in Portland for a decision on disability benefits and pension. Those disability ratings then often make you eligible for the federal VA health care, both at the local clinics that they've pushed out, as well as the major medical centers in Roseburg, Portland, and we even feed into Walla Walla and Boise as well. So beyond the benefit to the veterans and their families themselves, just an amazing $2.2 billion in 2013 dollars flow back from the federal VA back into Oregon. Somewhat incomprehensible, but half of that, $1.1 billion, is just cold hard cash of compensation and benefit payments coming into veterans' bank accounts and wallets. The other largest contingent of that is almost $1 billion in federal VA health care benefits, and then $128 million in education benefits in terms of the GI Bill, vocational rehab, and other efforts. What is in red is 2003, so about $1 billion in 2003, and now today $2.2 billion of federal VA dollars. So just looking back over the last decade, a significant infusion of federal VA dollars coming back, and again, that's off of 3 in 10 Oregon veterans accessing those benefits. So the more we are able to do our work and get in front of veterans and tie them into this system, the more federal VA dollars will draw down. And just to break down these numbers a little more, about $92 million, again, that cold hard cash of that $1.1 billion of compensation on disability and low-income pensions received by $92 million a month, received by about 61,000 veterans in 2013. Works out to be a per capita average of $14,271 per veteran, which exceeds the national average and kind of puts us into that top 10 metric, at least on that one measure. But even beyond that system, a very inverted pyramid with the $160 billion, the state programs on down to, in a rural county, sometimes just one shared veteran service officer across three rural counties. They are what helps navigate that system, but they are also helping navigate what is a broad public-private network, delivering veteran services in the community. From our political leadership to the public and private partners, it is not always ODVA or the National Guard or our local counterparts in the veterans services arena delivering the actual benefit, but us bringing our leadership, our advocacy, and our strong partnerships to bear across our partners with the universities, the community colleges, employment, and the employers, the private sector, the nonprofits, the faith-based community, and then all levels of government, including the tribes. So our main vision, our strategic framework that we've brought with our new team over the last year, our vision, veterans and their families thrive in Oregon. That's where we want to be. Our more targeted mission, ODVA serves and honors veterans through our leadership, our advocacy, and our strong partnerships, and then our core values of respect, integrity, stewardship, and excellence. It is such a diverse community and such a diverse range of issues that for a small 80 FTE department, you can, you know, with half of our general fund budget going down to the counties, you can quickly either put your head in the sand and kind of say, we're just going to take care of our core programs and do those core programs well. But the real opportunity is in the broader target veteran services, mobilize the partnerships, and drive veteran engagement. Historically, our strategic frameworks and strategic plans have focused more heavily on those core programs that we've had at our department, a home loan program since 1945, the care for our aging veterans in skilled nursing, both at the Dalles and the one we've stood up in Lebanon most recently, and then that claims and counseling. We still have to invigorate those core operations and bring those services to bear, but it's going to be the broader opportunities of mobilizing the federal VA resources and strengthening that county veteran service officer boots on the ground network. So some key strategies, investing in a 21st century veteran services system. This is still a very heavy paper-based system on up to the federal VA, even shipping paperwork to be scanned back in Minnesota from the feds. As it goes into a court review, the Veterans Court, shipping paper back and forth still, slowly but surely, they're about to flip the switch that we can have seamless electronic claims from the county through us and still ensure our power of attorney representation, but get a decision more quickly, given that there is a claims backlog. wanting to make sure that the veteran service officers are well-staffed and resourced, and really trying to bring greater clarity. What is the role in veteran services for a statewide agency vice that county role? It's been a muddling with that Marion and Polk that we provide at the local level here around our headquarters, but really trying to focus our statewide effort on that training, on the claims review, on the advocacy, and the value-added support down to the local level. Where we see momentum is often folks wanting to bring back that bacon to the local level, and where can we then use our state resources to strengthen that. Beyond the veteran services, also wanting to better connect them, veterans and their families, to those broader community resources. And these sometimes cross into each other. So mobilizing partnerships, we are not going to recreate wheels at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs that are at other agencies, but we want to bring that military veterans lens to their work, whether it's on specifically across two big buckets, health and wellness, and then education and economic opportunity. We don't need to recreate what addictions and mental health is doing, but we need to bring that military veterans lens on suicide prevention, on aging issues. We need to bring the military veterans lens to the employment department, to Business Oregon, and bring that leadership to bear. So it's not always going to be our core programs, but the broader partnerships, public and private. Beyond those two lanes, there is no shortage of resources for veterans and military families, but often it's who are the veterans, what are the resources, and how do you connect the two? Sometimes, as we heard, it's trying to create some peer-to-peer dynamic in terms of women veterans reaching out to women veterans, or tribal to tribal, or aging Vietnam vets to Vietnam vets. Trying to deepen that connection with the veteran community, separate out ourselves and our county partners as a distinct brand, separate and distinct from the federal VA, and ensure a positive experience for that word-of-mouth referral. And then lastly, invigorate, if we don't take care of our own core programs that we do have statutorily at the ODVA, we won't have the momentum to be able to drive the larger partnerships and the larger opportunities. So happy to take any questions. I appreciate you guys listening.
Questions?
Yes. Senator Olson and Senator
Biden. Well, to start with, Cameron, thank you very much, but I'm going to take exception to aging Vietnam veterans.
There's no exception.
There's no exception. In your program there, you talked that there are only 3 in 10 veterans take advantage of what's available to them. Is that because the other 70% are of middle income and don't have medical problems, et cetera, or are there programs available to someone such as myself who's a veteran that I can use that I don't know about?
So Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Olson, I think there's no doubt that many veterans come back and hit the ground running and thrive, going back to school, getting a job, and carrying on with their life, never needing to engage whether in state safety net services or more of the veterans ones. But I think no question that we have not tapped out on those, we're 10% of the population, but a quarter of all suicides in Oregon. So we know our veterans population has great needs, many of which could be helped and supported by both veteran services on up, FedVA on down, but also the public-private partners. And the comparison we use, about roughly the same percentage, or about the same number of veterans in Oregon as in Oklahoma, and they draw down about $400 million extra in disability compensation. And it's not that they're more disabled as a population there than we are. There's certainly some, we're never going to have 10 in 10, but moving that needle to 4 in 10, 5 in 10, accessing their benefits would be huge and powerful.
But that is the assumption that these people need some mm-hmm. kind of stable health care or whatever. Well, what about the veterans that don't need that? Are there programs available for them?
So Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Olson, I think it's the broader opportunity beyond health care benefits, beyond disability compensation, whether we're looking at education and making sure that our campuses are receptive to our returning veterans and supporting them, a very heavily supported GI Bill, but making sure they're getting successful outcomes on campus. The economic opportunity, so working with making sure that veterans have access to small business supports, opportunities for contracts. Many of our veterans come back and have that entrepreneurial and leadership experience and can be channeled into some other programs beyond some of the more welfare-based efforts.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cameron, I kind of along Senator Olson's question, and I wonder if the statistics are a little underreported, and I think, like myself, When I came back, I used a GI Bill. I bought a house with both a state and a federal GI loan, but I'm not doing anything now. So, Chair Devlin, like you said, don't have a need right now.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, so we can look at that in the statistics and see whether that metric is capturing the previous use of benefits as well or whether it's the ongoing. Yeah. So we'll take a look at that.
I'm very supportive of that. I think the new young minimum coming out with the availability of the GI Bill, which frankly is not as rich as it was when during our term, coming back from Vietnam. But how about health care? Are all veterans eligible for the federal health care clinics, or is it only the disabled?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, so out of the firestorm last summer on VA health care, I will say it's always been a challenge on access to health care. About 90,000 veterans in Oregon get their get some form of health care through the federal VA. It is largely, so there's kind of eight steps. Your higher income folks, not disabled folks, are going to be lower down on that priority list. So often that disability rating helps, but also income levels, and then some other qualifying factors due to your wartime service or specific awards from your service. So sometimes a complex formula, but I think it's going to be a fascinating conversation. Over time, demographically, as we lose those World War II and Korean War veterans, as we work our way through the Vietnam bubble over the next 30, 40 years, as we change healthcare models, both here locally and at the larger level, we have a brick-and-mortar VA healthcare system built out in the 30s and 50s based on where folks were living at the time. They've pushed out those smaller clinics, but there's going to be a balance, I think, between is that care provided within the VA healthcare system or is it more of a community-based service, more like the GI Bill model, where it is a Fed VA benefit but then provided by community partners.
I've watched and listened to all the criticism, but I have to say that for my father-in-law, my father-in-law is not alive anymore, but they're World War II vets. They got great service from the local Oregon Veterans Clinics.
And Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for those that get access, and sometimes it's a transportation issue or sometimes it's simply the access, but for those that get access, it's excellent care within the VA health care system.
Just pharmaceutical care. I mean, as you get up into the 80s and 90s, that there's a lot of pills. And the purchasing power there is very helpful.
And a lot of good models on the coordinated. It's a very much a coordinated care system for veterans. But then linking that to our CCO model here will be an interesting conversation going forward.
Appreciate the work you're doing.
Thanks.
I think I can't speak for the House, but the three of us were actually sitting here all thinking the same thing because I think I left the Marine Corps about 36 years ago.
Careful, they don't recall you.
Yeah.
That'd be a good idea.
I mean, all of us looking at ourselves says we have no service-connected disability, and we're fortunate in that. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering for the cases that, let me take in particular, some of the Vietnam veterans, could even go back farther, but I'm thinking Vietnam veterans in the time of the conflict, to which there are many Vietnam veterans older than any of the three of us, actually, to be reality in terms of how long the conflict was in place. And they have a disability that maybe was, it's service-connected, and maybe it was a disability they could live with on a normal basis. But as they've gotten older, the disability has been aggravated, and they get into this system. And the question I'm asking is, when they get into this system, I was reading one of your slides, and it can take up to, like, 2 years to get a decision. I think it was two. I'll have to check. The slide's not on right now. The 2 years to get a decision from the federal VA could be 4 years once you go through the appellate process. Are we lacking in terms of services in that interim, or are there services available to them? Or are they waiting in their final years of life, waiting on a decision that may not actually happen? And it may be post-mortem that the decision actually happens.
So Chair Devlin, members of the committee, both from how they were treated when they returned home, our Vietnam veterans did not always engage with the system right away, and often for 30 years. And then when Iraq and Afghanistan kicked off in the 2000s, many more then re-engaged finally. But also as they age, those issues are coming up more to the forefront, or also as they retire and have lower incomes, sometimes more eligible for different services. So very much the Vietnam veterans are driving both the claims process and the healthcare process as they age. There are not always, I mean, there are some limited emergency resources. You know, there are, both veterans are going to be eligible for other safety net services in the interim, sometimes much more of a straight income threshold for some of the other safety net services. But it does take a while to get through that process, which is trying to get our veterans to engage with that benefit system before they truly need it to be able to begin that process, because it's very much a workers' comp claim, trying to prove something became of your service 40 years ago in the jungles of Vietnam can be a lengthy process through that veterans claim system. So not anything straight through the veteran services that's a gap fill, other than the broader resources that we can connect them to, both public and private.
The other thing, and I think it's been brought up here, if I think as you work in terms of some of your strategic planning, it would be helpful to the legislature, I think, if you could get some more detailed data. I mean, one of the questions came up here that I was thinking about had nothing to do with disability or low-income pensions. Had to do with how many veterans are actually availing themselves of their educational benefits.
So Chair Devlin, members of the committee, breaking down those silos, I think, is a goal for every agency on that data. We are serving multiple clients across our different systems. That's a core area, I think, for ODVA to invest in, both from a staff and policy perspective, but also from that IT and database perspective. And I kind of model it a little bit off of what the Criminal Justice Commission does on public safety. They are that link in terms of analyzing a lot of the different data, both from the feds, from DOC, from the sheriffs at the local level. That's a role I think that ODVA could grow into, but has not been a sweet spot that we've invested in capabilities to date. But to be able to share that across with the universities and the community colleges and the employment, we often get asked to testify on any given veterans population and any given issue. We can dig in and go get that data and do a good presentation, but we don't have a culture of keeping that living and continuing throughout the year and throughout our programs to move the needle on the outcomes. That's coming.
Additional questions? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
We will move on to our next item, which we're going to have an update on two technology projects. The first one will be the Oregon State Police Crime View. Captain Worthy. And David Alamine. And I apologize in advance. Jennifer
Bjork.
And if you could start in whatever order you've predetermined is the appropriate order.
Certainly. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Tom Worthy. I'm a captain with the Oregon State Police. I brought with me today David Alamine, seated to my right, who's the department's chief information officer, and seated immediately to his right is Jennifer Bjerke, and she is the Department of State Police's strategic technology officer at DAS, also responsible for all public safety. We're here to present to you today an important public safety information technology project that we know as the Crime View Replacement Project. And I have a series of slides to present to you today, the estimated duration of which will be about 15 to 20 minutes. And the overview will be a description of the purpose of the Crime View project, and it'll describe what Crime View and LEDS, or the Law Enforcement Data System, is, and who the customers are that are served by the systems, as well as a greater detailed discussion of what the CrimeView database contains and the LEDS system provides. And then I'll also share the proposed project timeline and a rough order of magnitude cost estimate as we know it today, and present a summary of risks of failure to act now. And then, of course, the committee will have a chance to ask questions at the end if you so choose. The CrimeView replacement project purpose, as you see here, is to improve the department's ability to provide access to critical information for law enforcement as well as regulatory entities in the state, and enhance the data that's able to be delivered to those stakeholders through our system. The Oregon State Police is the agency charged with keeping and maintaining the system that contains information such as warrants, protective orders, criminal history, et cetera, the very core information that all law enforcement needs to do our job. This system replacement will allow the Oregon State Police to maintain our service level while also meeting the demand for newly available criminal justice tools that the FBI might mandate from us or reporting to the legislature or other entities that need data contained in those systems. So LEDS and CrimeView provide the sole source repository for criminal justice information in Oregon. There is nowhere else that you can go to get this data. It resides in our system only, and it's critical that it be maintained and available for the customers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, with a very high degree of system uptime. We support the criminal justice system, law enforcement officers, as well as other agency partners and non-criminal justice agency partners, such as regulatory boards, licensing boards, pre-employment screening, and checks such as this to know, especially when somebody's going to be interacting with a vulnerable population, such as a preschool or elderly care, something like that. This is the system that's checked to provide those background checks for people in those lines of work. And also, it's the system that provides criminal justice data exchange around the world. Our system touches not just Oregon data, but reaches out and touches data from other states and other countries as well. And so if a officer needed to run a check through Interpol, for instance, this is the system that they would be checking. Interpol is international police, which could tell you if somebody had a warrant in, say, France, for instance. The customers served by the system in the state of Oregon, over 700 local, state, and federal criminal justice agencies, about 45,000 law enforcement and criminal justice agencies nationwide, 130 or so non-criminal justice agencies here in Oregon, and about 1,200 federally licensed firearm dealers, and 3.9 million Oregon citizens. In Oregon, you can access this system to check your own criminal history. You can take a look at it at a small cost by contacting our CJIS division. And if you had a question about a disposition of an old case or something like that, you can look at it, and for that matter, you can also check someone else's criminal history through this system, and they'll be notified of it, of course, but that's a service that's available also. Oregon's very open with our records, and under the right criteria and the notifications, that's a possibility as well. So every citizen of Oregon is potentially a customer of this system. So what is CrimeView? I've been speaking about CrimeView like we're all as familiar with it as the people sitting at this table, and we aren't necessarily. CrimeView is essentially a database. It contains criminal history records that are updated through OSP CJIS division by looking at court dispositions, and those records are all verified individually by a biometric, meaning that you'll need a fingerprint for a addition to your criminal history. It's the sole repository of this information, and so it has to be correct, of course. Sitting around CrimeView is a series of what we know as hot files. Hot files are things like warrants, protective orders, identity theft notifications, other administrative files, officer safety notifications. These are the files when a police officer stops someone on the side of the road and runs a LEDS check or runs a query through their mobile computer or their dispatch center. This is where they're looking in Oregon. So this system is directly responsible for keeping officers safe, as well as taking bad people off the road every single day. But there's approximately 32 million total transactions across the system into the CrimeView database every year, and the system uptime is required to be virtually nonstop. It's listed here as 99.9% of the time. We angle for about 16 minutes of downtime a year, if possible, for system maintenance. So what is LEDS? LEDS, you've probably heard of or are familiar with. It's Law Enforcement Data Systems. It's greater than just the singular database that's known as CrimeView. It's the connectivity. It's the LEDS message switch that routes incoming queries. Depending on how a query from a law enforcement officer or a dispatch center is formatted, I may be interested in knowing if somebody has a warrant in Oregon, but I may also be interested in knowing if somebody has a warrant in Florida, Kentucky. And the message switch that's foundational to LEDS tells that query where to go and which files to check. And if I wanted to check a driver's license in Minnesota or Ohio, I can key in the correct query, and the message switch routes that to the holder of that data. LEDS doesn't hold that data, but the home state does, and the message switch routes it accordingly and returns a return from the state in about 1.7 seconds. So the CrimeView replacement project, what the critical needs and problems are, and what spurs this replacement on our side. The technology is old. This database was purchased by Oregon 19 years ago, and so I think of it as, you know, since it is a database, it's technology, and I think back to what my cell phone looked like 19 years ago. It didn't even exist 19 years ago, so it is end of life and in critical need of replacement. It's not supported by a vendor. This is a database that is supported in-house by Oregon State Police. We purchased it from the company SAIC years and years ago, and there is a risk of catastrophic failure within the system, which is just not acceptable to us or any of our partners. Of course, as the stewards of the system, we can't allow that to happen. And we know that the system as it is now really doesn't meet modern standards for reliability and security and sustained operations and development as well. So on a side note, our main developer in the system last Friday was 50 years old, and he passed away unexpectedly. So that's illustrative of the risk around this system. That it's difficult to support now, it's old, and it puts us in a difficult position to try and keep the old system alive in its current state. So our proposed timeline for the project, we think that it's going to take approximately two biennia to move the project forward. We are still in project pre-initiation phase. We've been working closely with our partners at Jennifer's shop and others, as well as engaging our partners in the criminal justice community through the Criminal Justice Standards Advisory Board and others, reaching out to the chiefs and sheriffs to let them know that this is a critical system replacement, and seeking their support and at least their understanding of it. We have estimated this project on a rough order of magnitude around $11.6 million is the best that we understand it now. And of course, as we move through the stage gate process and get further through a request for proposal, these numbers will come into sharper focus for us and we'll all have a better idea. But the best that we know right now is about $11.6 billion. So we, I think I touched on some of this already, but risk of failure to act should CrimeView become inaccessible to the law enforcement community in Oregon. Of course, a police officer on patrol would be unable to know if somebody is wanted or if a vehicle is stolen that they're encountering in the field. We wouldn't be able to determine if a firearm was transferred to a prohibited person or if a firearm was stolen that was encountered in the field. And it would prevent us, wouldn't prevent a registered sex offender from providing direct care to vulnerable populations. I think I touched on that a little bit earlier as well. This system also allows us to uphold protection orders and keep people who are in danger safe and make appropriate hiring or licensing decisions for sensitive populations, as well as returning stolen property to the rightful owners. So we know that if we can move through this project, successfully replace the database and the system surrounding it, we can continue to provide this level of service to the criminal justice community. And when I say that, I really don't mean just law enforcement. Of course, it's regulatory and courts. You know, judges use this system to make sentencing decisions and really beyond that. So that's really the crux of my presentation for today, and we're all here happy to take any questions if the committee has any.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Captain Worthy, obviously it's a very important system, and obviously something needs to be fixed. I guess my question goes to, it strikes me that this type of system, particularly with the way it's interconnected with many, many others, is this something that, for lack of a better, we can buy off the shelf? Other states have a good one. Can we borrow the software or buy the software and adapt it? Or is there a service bureau out there that's servicing people that we can buy the service from that would keep it up?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, that's our intent through this system replacement, is to move to a commercial off-the-shelf system. This is an industry that exists out there, and we've looked across the U.S. Fortunately for the Oregon State Police, we're not alone in the need for this system replacement. Many states are in lockstep with us in that their systems are beginning to age as well, just the way ours are, and there are vendors out there that have identified this need in the public safety community and have products that address exactly this. So our intent is not to do this in-house. It's not a core competency of the agency to be a programming shop. It's not something we should do, or although we have talented people, it's just not an area that we want to be in. So yes, to answer your question, we do intend to find something that is in use elsewhere and that meets our needs.
So are these cloud-based services that are out there now?
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, there are not currently cloud-based offerings that I'm aware of. That is certainly an industry trend, and we know from talking to vendors initially that they do want to head in that direction. But remember also that these are the highest security records that we're in possession of, and there's a whole bunch of security requirements around that.
Got
so
a little puts and takes on that one. You've got a system that you need it to be very common across all of the agencies, I guess globally, but on the other hand, you want a very secure system.
Yeah. Senator Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, yes, security is central to our needs in this system, and also there are some Oregon customizations to the system that exist only here. So while we angle to buy an off-the-shelf system, directly off-the-shelf plug in and turn on, it probably isn't practical. There will be need to be customization for Oregon only.
And I see in your timeline that you've got the business case approval targeted for the CIO's approval. I think it's this month, next month? So they have been, DAS has been involved, and the CIO has been involved in this?
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, yes, sir. We've been reaching out to our partners across the entity of the state of Oregon since the very beginning on this. We're trying to work with our partners, and the stage gate process is rigorous, and it is it's a high bar to clear, and the only way that we're going to do that is by working with the CIO's office.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Captain Worthy. I appreciate your dissertation. A question on the hardware in the vehicles on your troopers on the road. Will we need to upgrade that to work the new system? And is that included in your budget?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, Senator Olson, it's a greater question than that since all agencies touch the system. And so if you think across all of the public safety, just from the police points of view, there's many, many different kinds of devices in the car. So most of this will be happening on the back end. And really, if we do this right, this is not going to require a hardware change in the car. We're mostly talking about database interfaces and message switch. So it's after the query or the electronic request has hit the network and arrived down here in Salem.
Captain Worthy, just do you know if I see that the source for funding, part of it is general funds, part of it is other funds. Could you identify the source for the other funds, and can you let me know if the governor has included this in his recommended budget?
Yes, sir. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, that's right. There is a mix of funds in this project. And I'm not the full disclosure, I'm not the finance guy on this,
okay.
But I will tell you that the agency has about $1 million up front of general fund, and we have that within our current agency limitation.
Okay.
Moving forward through the project, it'll be a mix of other funds as well as general fund.
But you don't know at this stage whether it was included in the governor's recommended budget.
This project is included in the governor's recommended budget.
Additional questions? Did your panelists wish to say anything, or were they here just to answer questions?
For questions so far, sir, Chair Devlin, and if you want to hit them directly, that's...
Well, thank you very much for the presentation, and thank all three of you for being here today. Very much appreciated.
Thank you.
We'll close that, and we'll go on to a update on the Revenue Core Systems Replacement Project for the Department of Revenue. Mr. Smith, are you here? Yes. And just proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Smith, and I'm the administrator of the Program Management Office for the Department of Revenue, and I'm pleased to provide you with a brief update today as we have just completed the first of four rollouts in our core system replacement project. I'll give you a quick overview of the project, a brief recap of the events that went on before we went live, a current status report on the project and some of the things that we're doing right now as we look forward to our next rollout. You've seen this slide before. This is the slide that I used to refresh your memory about the purpose for our project. We're replacing about two-thirds of our tax processing systems, primarily to reduce risk from us being able to sustain those into the future. But we're also fortunate to be in a space where there's some commercial off-the-shelf solutions that will help us improve our business processes. And so we've selected Fast Enterprises to install their Gentax product. The thing you haven't seen on this slide is we can say we went live on schedule November 12th and under budget, and the system is working well for the corporation cigarette and tobacco tax programs. So we're very pleased to report that to you today. System costs are still estimated around $80 million. This is a visual of what the environment looks like that our staff are migrating from. This is our green screen environment. It's just a screen. An interesting side note, I have a daughter who went to school at a state agency, and she came home one day and she started to describe this computer screen she had to work on. And as she started to describe it, I said, honey, that's what I've been working for 5 years to replace. And so people often come into our workplace and they're not used to these types of systems. They're used to these types of systems. And so here's a more Windows-based, tab-oriented screen that is easier to navigate. Instead of knowing codes to move around in the old system where you had to predict where you wanted to go and enter the right code to get there, here you're able to navigate by clicking on tabs once you understand what's behind each tab and move around much more quickly in the system. It's integrated so that anybody in the organization who has the right access can look up a customer's account information. They can see what letters have been sent to those customers. They can look at payment information. It's a much more robust system. A little bit of background about our cutover weekend. On Friday, November 7th at 5:30, we shut down our legacy systems, and we partnered very closely with Enterprise Technology Services. Throughout the weekend, we had over 40 staff working through the weekend. Once we had shut down the systems, we did data saves once before we converted data and then once after. Early Saturday morning, we converted the data for the three tax programs in rollout one. And by about 10 o'clock Saturday morning, we reconciled $4,421,400,865.99 of tax to the penny. And the reason we were able to be so successful in doing that is the vendor that we've selected, as we have said prior to you giving us permission to go forward, has a lot of experience with this. And they have a staging environment where we can practice converting our legacy data from our legacy system into the new system over and over again. And we did that for a few months before we went live, so we could find over 30-some data anomalies, and then the staff in the programs would correct those anomalies and get the data ready to convert. We then validated the functionality of the system. We made sure that it was behaving the way that we expected it to behave based on how we had configured the system to meet our needs. We validated also that our legacy systems, which we made changes to, we don't want them to recognize transactions anymore for corporation cigarette and tobacco tax programs. We can see data there, but we don't want them to be able to be used. We want one system of record. And so those legacy system changes were made, and they worked well. And then the final thing we did that weekend was verify that the data was accurate. And that's not just the financials, but it's also the address information, account information, all the information associated with the accounts we transferred. Once we believed that the system had received the data correctly, we then processed the information that we had been holding on to in our legacy system so we could clear the pipeline from our legacy system. So we had actually held corporate returns for almost 2 months, and we had held payments for a little over a week. And we processed those through the new system, and then on Monday morning, when staff came in, there's 687 staff that have access to the system for their jobs for the Rollout 1 programs. It was a read-only mode for Monday, so they could verify that their user information was correct, their user profile was correct, that they had the right security level. And so we addressed some of the things that we found that we needed to correct in that. And then Tuesday, which was a holiday, we all rested. And then Wednesday morning when we came in, we were in full production mode and everybody was able to fully access the system to the extent they needed to do their jobs for the Rollout One programs. Wednesday night, we ran our first production jobs. So when we process payments or process returns on Wednesday, we ran our first daily production jobs. They worked well, and we verified that all of our interfaces were working between the Department and Treasury, the Department and State Printing, and internally as well. Regarding scope, all of the relevant scope requirements for the rollout programs were met. And here there are a few bullets to just talk about our scope management process. But the thing that I want to point out that we're very pleased with is the bottom bullet, and that is we were able to re-engineer our business processes and leverage the COT solution out of the box so that we did no customization for Rollout One programs. We're not sure we'll be able to do that for all programs, but we're pleased for at least the first three that we were able to not do any customization. Our goal is to minimize customization so it'll be a lot easier to maintain and support this COT solution into the future. Regarding schedule, as I said, we went live on schedule November 12th, and we continue to operate under budget. We're about $6.7 million under budget for this biennium, and the biggest driver for that is you gave us $3 million of contingency fund that we have not needed any of that. We also have some savings from some lower than anticipated hardware costs and lower than anticipated ETS service charges. Those are the three big pieces. After going live, we provided a lot of training to the staff who were impacted and their jobs were going to be using the new system. But when we went live, we had over 40 people who were spread throughout the agency and our field offices to provide what we call desk side support. So as the people were there doing their jobs with the new system, if they had questions about what they had learned in training or they had something new come up that maybe was not covered in training, we had people who were available to help them. And that happened for about 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, it really wasn't necessary. In fact, it tapered off in some areas in the agency more quickly than that. There were a couple of areas where their jobs changed quite a bit that they needed desk side support a little bit longer, but they're doing very well right now. We're in the stabilization phase for the Rollout One programs where we're monitoring and refining the system business processes. In those areas where we did change business processes, there are a few areas where we're finding as we do the work day in and day out that maybe we could do things a little differently. The nice thing about a highly configurable system like this is we're readily able to make some changes and modify those business processes. Due to the held production that we had, we sent out over 5,000 notices in the second week that we were live. Once we had processed them, we verified all of our correspondence, over 10,000 pieces of correspondence, make sure it was accurate before we sent it out. And the final thing I would share is that we have some new online services, especially for our cigarette and tobacco taxpayers, and some new functions for our corporate taxpayers online. And so we've been very strategic in how we're reaching out and communicating to those businesses about some of the new services that are available to them. We've already begun ramping up for Rollout 2. Rollout 2 is going to be monumental. That's where the personal income tax program is. And this was quite an effort to do this, but for Rollout 2, because of the magnitude of the data that we're going to be converting, the number of employees that are going to be impacted, it's our largest division. This is going to take everything we have to do this and do this well over the next year. Personal income tax, the self-employed transit tax, estate and trust taxes, senior disabled and deferral taxes, and then on your request, we moved the emergency communications 911 tax from Rollout 3 into Rollout 2 as well so that we could do retail sales of prepaid phone cards. This is my last slide, and it's actually a graphic that I stole from one of the vendors that we have hired to come alongside of us as a project management advisor. And they were more or less documenting the keys to success for our first rollout. And you know, on the bottom are the planning and the adherence to those plans, things that we're talking about, of course, through the stage gate process that we're refining as a state. But in the middle, what I'd like to point out is some key pillars. We hired a very competent vendor. Fast Enterprises has done this over and over again, and their methodology for implementing their system is very well thought out, and we were able to staff to the needs that we had to bring to the table to partner with them to bring it in on schedule. And as I had mentioned earlier, the multiple mock conversions, when you're making a major transfer to a new system, the key is data and data accuracy. And converted data has different nuances that you need to address. It often behaves differently than native data that comes into the system after you've gone live. And by practicing over and over for several months how that data would convert and how it behaved in the new system enabled us to be able to be ready to hit the ground running when we went live on November 12th. So that was a big key to our success. And then the fact that they have a stage environment. So we were able to, when we converted data in to the system, in fact, we would even take, in legacy, we would be processing payments, say in October, we'd be processing payments through the system. We would take that same payment stream after we ran it through legacy, and we'd run the data through the new system in a staging environment, and those same employees would practice doing their job in the new environment that they had just done in the old environment with the old payments. And so they could see how they were going to do their job in the new environment with the same transaction data that we were dealing with that day. And so that staging environment has been a real benefit to us to be prepared to go live and hit the ground running. So that's basically what I hope to share with you today. Happy to entertain questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric, how does this impact a business taxpayer in terms of like doing their quarterly payments? Does it have any impact on that? Or
Chair Devlin, Senator Beyer, they will still be able to do their payments the way they always have. If they used an EFT payment method, they would have a different opportunity on our website to do it in a different method, but we communicated to the businesses the bigger impacts were more to the tobacco taxpayers, but we have some frequently asked questions for any change that had happened. But
yes, one of the long-term goals that I think we've talked about through the business portal, the Secretary of State's thing, is that at some point getting to it where a business, for all the various interactions they have to have with the state, would be able to go in one time, put in their ID information, and then when they needed to make a tax payment or a DEQ report or something like that, they'd only have to go in and put their, if you will, a username in, and the form would self-populate, except they would have to try well, this system, if you changed it, allow that somewhere down in the future when we get that all worked out?
Chair Devlin, Senator Beyer, I'm aware of the Oregon Business Registry that Secretary of State has coordinated, and we do use that. And so especially when we get into the withholding program, which is in Rollout 3, which is where most of the businesses register with us, we will continue to understand how our system interacts with that system that helps to bring all the other agencies' information together. And being configurable like it is, hopefully we'll be able to be more nimble to be able to address any of the continuing evolution of that.
Good. I guess that's a long-term goal. I just ask that you keep that in mind as we kind of go down there. I know what happens behind the screen is of less importance to the taxpayers out there, but from them, just an easy way to get in and do their business, and however we need to work towards that.
Any additional questions? Yes. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a question, but first I wanted to hear you say it again. You're saying this was on time and it was under budget, right?
Chair Devlin, Representative Thatcher, correct.
I should hear champagne corks popping all over the building right now.
Thank you.
Confetti falling from the ceiling. Anyhow, you mentioned a rollout 3. Is that the final rollout, or are there more rollouts?
Chair Devlin, Representative Thatcher, we have 4 rollouts. Okay. And so the second rollout, personal income tax, and the other programs are listed. The third rollout will be our withholding tax. Mm-hmm. And we will also do a lot of collections for other agencies or other agency accounts. And we have some smaller programs like state lodging tax. And that's in our third rollout. The fourth rollout is more or less a lot of smaller programs that you've asked us to administer that are there are more accounting functions. And that will be concluded by the fall of 2017. And so we will be completely through implementation by 3 years from now. And hopefully things continue to go as successfully as they have been. And then we'll be in a maintenance and support mode going forward from there.
Any additional? Representative Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, greatly appreciated that particular observation under budget and on time. As well as the rest of your presentation, you said that there have been, you talked about configurations and customization, and what a nicely configurable program we have collectively decided to implement.
You said no costs have been incurred for customization at this point, but you think that there may be in the future. Could you comment a little bit and understand that I'm hoping there won't be any at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, we don't plan on having to pay any additional costs, even if we did have to customize some of the core code that's in Gentex. That's included in our fixed price agreement. They need to deliver the business functionality we need. The only reason why we may need to consider customization, if there is some business functionality we need that they cannot configure the system to meet, and we're hoping if it happens at all to be very minor, that will be included in the price we've already paid for that system. And I hope I answered your question correctly.
I suspect you did. Follow up?
Yes.
Thanks. I suspect you did. I'm wrestling with the business model that would enable them to do that, that would enable a vendor to give you a price that included ongoing customization of code. Configuration, yeah. But customization of code for one site is it's a real challenge for a vendor.
Senator Devlin, Representative Harker, they have done this. We were the 19th state revenue agency to go live. There are some states that refused to depart from their old ways of doing business in some areas and had quite a bit of customization. And so Fast Enterprises is very used to our workspace, the types of programs we're doing, and what the impact is on them if they do need to do customization. And I believe that they brought that experience to the table when they saw our business requirements and what they were bidding on. And I believe they probably accounted for any possible customization in the fixed price agreement that we have with them. That's my best estimate to answer your question, sir.
Okay. I'll leave office, but stay tuned.
Just one thing for the record. I think, do you still have the same caveat in place? Any members that have massive ideas about changes in the personal income tax system or disconnecting from the federal system in different ways should please make those effective after your transition? Is that
Thank you, Senator Devlin. And if Mr. Buholtz, our director, were here, he would echo that. We're all in on this for this next 2 years, and we will certainly want to partner with you on anything that you have in terms of policy changes, but please work with us on timing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Committee members, we've been seated for about an hour and 20 minutes, so I think maybe we'll take about a 7 or 8 minute break, and I'll reconvene at 3:30.
Sounds good.
If people want to get us set up. Or
I appreciate that.
On legislative audits and information management and technology for December 9th, 2014. We have a few items remaining on our agenda. Some of them, at least this next one, is probably amongst the most complex. I'm setting you up. Mr. Pettit and Mr. Jordan, if you'd like to proceed, whenever you choose to proceed.
Thank you, Mr.
Whichever order you choose to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the state and the Director at the Department of Administrative Services. With me today is Alex Pettit, the state CIO. I'm the window dressing on the presentation. I'd like to just take a couple of slides to set some context. Alex will go through the meat of the presentation. The reason we're here today, bottom line, is to talk with you about a couple of things regarding the HRIS business case that we've been working on for some time. Along with that, LFO asked us rightfully to take a longer view of our legacy systems and to put this HRIS system replacement into a larger context and give you some sense of our longer range plan regarding those things. And then Alex is also going to talk about his resource strategic plan. So that's basically the lineup for today. The next slide we'll have, I wanted to set a little bit of context. What Alex is going to talk to you about is not happening in a vacuum. We have a lot of things going on and have been going on for the last couple of years. I was fond a couple of years ago of telling people that the state, as an enterprise, couldn't even make a bad decision about IT. We couldn't make any decision. We had no venue. We had no process by which to make an enterprise-wide decision about technology. In the last 2 years, we've gone through a process to build a governance structure. We now that now represents across the executive branch of state government. We have also, under that, put together a pilot project to implement that governance system, so it isn't just a committee of people that make decisions. There are now strategic technology offices in 3 of the 5 policy areas. We've mapped agencies to those policy areas, and those officers have responsibility to both be a consultant, particularly for small agencies that don't have a lot of IT capacity, and help them with some of those things, but also with larger agencies. Some of the issues we have faced historically in the organization is that we have bought technology or we have built our own technology and, quite frankly, have been reluctant to examine our business processes. So again, as I'm fond of saying, we put Chanel No. 5 on a pig a number of times. We were unwilling to change our business processes. That is changing, and it will continue to change. As you just heard from revenue, they have taken what is essentially an off-the-shelf system, and they have adjusted their business processes to make sure that they can take full advantage of the technology that they're putting in place. That will be the norm as we go forward, not the exception for us. So those strategic technology officers are there to act as consultants and traffic cops. You know that we have a lot of very small agencies and small programs out there. Sometimes their technology need is unique to them, and we should be looking at a unique application. But often their need is common. And so their job, these technology officers' job, is also to elevate those decisions where we think we should be doing a shared service model among multiple programs in multiple agencies, perhaps. And by extension, potentially, we have an enterprise-wide solution that we should be implementing. So they act both as consultant and traffic cop to try and get the right decision in the right venue for us to be able to make that across the whole enterprise. We have a pop in the DAS budget in the CIO's office for this next budget cycle to spread that pilot across all of the policy areas and bolster their capability in business analysis. We have some pretty good technology people, no doubt about it, but we're short a little on resource regarding helping agencies analyze their business processes and, again, avoid that putting the technology onto a bad business process. So we have a pop in, and we'll go through, obviously, ways and means to expand that. We've collaborated with LFO to build the stage gate process, which you've heard alluded to in a couple of different presentations today. That now is becoming institutionalized in the way we do business, really about putting more rigor around pre-project planning and the notion of incremental delivery, making sure that we're delivering in increments and checking and adjusting as we need to. And you saw that in spades in the revenue project approach. So we're attempting to make that happen, and that's been a great collaboration with LFO. We are doing a service assessment of our technology services at ETS, what you may know as the State Data Center. Not only is IT governance about making sure we deliver on projects, but it's also about making sure we're using the right business process to actually deliver IT. So should we be doing everything ourselves? Should we be using vendors in certain elements of our IT delivery system? And so this governance process, Alex is doing an assessment now of all of those service delivery components. And those will be elevating to IT governance to make some what might be really significant decisions about the way we deliver IT services inside state government. Enterprise architecture is an interesting one that we are just beginning kind of the notion of what we're going to do there, but it is a very big notion. We've been fond through all of this work in the last 2 years of really the mantra has been the business leads the technology, right? What is becoming more and more evident to us is that we don't understand our business well enough to tell our technology people what solution we really need and what our problem really is. And so enterprise architecture, while it might sound like a technology term, is really about business process and mapping your business processes, the who, what, when, why, how of all of our processes. And it's going to be a long-term maturation process. It's not a project that you get done in a year or something. We will start, but it will be a long-term process by which we mature the way managers understand their business and then work with technologists to apply the right tool to the right issue. And then lastly, Alex is going to talk about the legacy system upgrade, which I had mentioned. And so all of those things are going on pretty much simultaneously for us. Fortunately, we did the governance first, and it is kind of the venue for all of this work and making sure that it all meshes, obviously, with Alex's staffing us and making sure we get it done right. So he has a very clever graphic here that I'm not sure I completely understand, but I want to talk to you about it as far as how it sets up Alex's presentation. In the past, we had developed a number of these core legacy systems. They are all custom written, but we did them as shared services 20 to 30 years ago in some cases. We organized our businesses around them in agency land, if you will, and that was the way we did this a couple of decades ago. Over the last couple of decades, guess what? The world has changed. Our core systems, however, have not been able to adjust to those changes in business process and in the environment. And what has happened over time is that agencies have developed shadow systems and workarounds and other things that they can do to fill the gaps that occur in our core systems. What we hope to do in the future, through the process of the planning and beginning hopefully with ATRIS, is redevelop those core systems again to the degree that they need to be enterprise-wide shared service delivery. And I think one thing through the governance process that we are attempting to do, in very simple terms, is manage that tension between where do we experience real value in scale and in standardization for big systems, and where do we need to be nimble and creative and very specific about serving a particular programmatic need when it comes to technology. Managing that tension is really what governance is about in our case, and we actuate that through the strategic technology officers. So that's kind of my end of setting the stage for you of all the things that are going on, and I'll let Alex talk about ELSA and the rest.
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alex Pettit. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the State of Oregon. I've got a number of things to go through. I'm going to go through these pretty quickly because there's a lot of material here. It's important to me that I communicate effectively, so if there are things that I perhaps need to expound upon further, please let me know and I'll help out as much as I can. First, the vision and the drivers that led us to where we were. So our vision is to identify the services and delivery process gaps that we have in the existing services, core services that we provide as a state, remove unnecessary entropy from the system without impacting service delivery. That is, what does it take? It takes a great deal of effort and energy to sustain the system as it exists today. That's because of some things are duplicative, some things are unnecessary, some things are done because this is how we've always done it, or there was a rule or a process or something in place that served a need that no longer served it. That entropy is simply lost energy to us right now. Application of resources in a non-redundant way and changing the focus from the current service levels approach to what and where new initiatives can be made. Our drivers are timing, 12 core systems augmented with dozens of shadow systems. So many of the bespoke systems that are maintained by agencies, unique systems to those agencies in that work in tandem with the core systems, are not necessarily for unique services to that agency. So in many cases, those things should be centralized and provided through a unified solution. Cost and funding. In our traditional implementation approach, this will take over $100 million and an extent of about 15 years. And as Captain Worthy had said, some of the people that are currently supporting of our systems will not only be retired, they could be dead before we get it done. So it's hard for us to sustain systems when the authors are unable to accept contracts for extension of their services. acceptance, support, and change management. There was a core and has been a core expression of fear of particularly IT change managed projects. These are really business change projects. However, there is a great deal of reluctance to embrace change as it is authored by technology changes. And finally, our delivery models, as had been alluded to in other presentations, our stage gate process, our incremental delivery, and our goal is not to go from 12 systems, which we currently have, down to one, but rather to 12 to four or fewer systems, four primary areas, procure to pay, hire to retire, our accounting and budgeting, our accounting process and our budgeting process. Those are really the four areas or four categories of services. Within those will be unified. We expect those to be unified. There may be the same solution for multiple categories or groupings of those services, but our desire is not to go to a single solution for all of them. So we don't wish to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. So really it's a balance, as Michael had referred to, between what things should be shared, what services should be centralized or shared services, and what services should be distributed or bespoke to the agency. In many cases, the shared services support bespoke services, but that definition, that process of determining what is bespoke and what is shared, that is a governance, that is essentially a governance process. And this is kind of the current state of enterprise resource planning in the state of Oregon today. As you can see, we have many solutions that are fully implemented or are centralized services, as you see in benefits, payroll, human resources, budgeting, procurement, financial services. Those services are fully implemented, but there are multiple, in many cases, agency-specific solutions that provide some very sophisticated solutions, some Access database solutions, some simply Excel spreadsheet solutions. They vary. And then you see those things that are partially implemented in yellow. Perhaps I should have used a different color. And those things which are not implemented at this time but would likely be a shared service or should be a unified service, such as asset management, where in the procure-to-pay process you would have an asset that comes in, it's procured, it gets entered into the asset management database as it goes through its life cycle. So we started out by collecting empirical data. Rather than going to, everyone has one of the things from having done three of these in my lifetime, enterprise resource planning implementations, everyone has, you ask three different people, you have three different opinions of what the approach ought to be. I've done them financials first, I've done them human resource applications first, so I've done them in parallel, I've done them at Brown University, at the state of Oklahoma, and at the city of Denton, Texas. So we've done, and again, everyone has. So the first thing that I wanted to do, and it's particularly around the concern that was expressed through a lot of different, that there were other ways or other approaches we should take, is go out and actually gather some empirical data from the folks that are going to be doing the heavy lifting on this. So 42 agencies were surveyed on the current legacy systems and their computing needs. The business leader survey results, and I have those if you'd like to see them. HR and budgeting, PPDB and PICS were the legacy systems expressed with the highest need for replacement. SFMS was the system with the lowest need for replacement, and all the other legacy systems, there is a need to be replaced, if for no other reason than because of where they are in their life cycle. So they're well over 15 years old and are in need of replacement. A widespread agreement that these processes should be common: human capital management, business intelligence, time and attendance, accounting, procurement, sourcing. An enterprise system for following business practices is highly needed in asset management, inventory tracking, time and attendance, accounts payable. And the most desired capacity that agencies have shown interest is in manager and employee self-service screens, where a manager could see when was the last time they had given a review to someone, when is the next review due, all kinds of, and an employee can change, if they have a change in circumstance, they can change their information about themselves, where they live, insurance information, things like that. Themes captured from the survey. These were comments that we got back on the different areas, human capital management, finance and grants, and budgeting and analytics. So lacking functionality, agencies' accounting needs are common. There's a need for common purchasing software. I won't read them all off aloud to you, but there were some, there were themes. There was general agreement that all of them need to be replaced. And then we did a second data gathering exercise where we did a strategy lab with Deloitte in October of this year. We brought together 29 IT and business executives from 20 different state agencies to participate in a full-day lab to discuss these different systems and solutions. And the way that this was set up is Deloitte brought in about 10 people and set up work areas or workshops, little mini workshops, in budgeting and procurement to pay in human resources and in accounting. And groups rotated among them to find out what leading practices were, what other states were doing, what the state of California had done, what the state of New York had done, what the state of Florida had done, and so on, to kind of get an understanding of where our peers are and where they're moving. So some of our conclusions first. There's a great deal of work that needs to be done in a short amount of time. Moving from 12 core systems to 4 represents a significant improvement for the state. Change management, communication, leadership, and early wins are all keys to success, and HRIS is clearly the most urgent need with the most readiness expressed. This, we asked people with a sophisticated colored post-it note strategy to vote with red, yellow, and green post-it notes, which they believed were the most urgent needs to be addressed. And in the lab, in our lab, HCM was expressed as the highest need, and you see there from that. So this is a little different than the survey data, except that HCM was consistently expressed as the system with the highest need for replacement. So then we came up with our high-level implementation plan. And again, this was in the lab, and we worked through, the participants helped us devise. Some of them were rather skeptical in their process, so they put down the 20-year timeline for what they felt it would take to do this. But when it was done, we came to an agreement. The red dotted red line there represents where we are today. And we are in the process of devising the process standardization around PPDB, PICS, position control, and personnel. And we are moving into an RFP issuance of an RFI and then an RFP to refine that a little bit to issue that in order to get solicitations. We've brought this as far as we can without getting data from the and understanding what solutions are out in the commercial market. And it is our intent to bring in a COTS solution, so commercial off the shelf. Critical success factors, change management, involve the right people in our culture change, leadership, we need a robust governance process, communications, agency support for common platform, stakeholder management, budget, and we desperately need an early win, a small win, and capture that recipe so we can all taste success was one of those things that was clearly expressed through the lab and through the survey results. Mm-hmm. So again, HRIS is clearly the most urgent need with the most readiness. The business case has been completed. We can't move forward without more information. Market information will be brought back to 2015 session for consideration. Oh, I'm sorry. This was your slide, wasn't it?
No.
Oh, okay. And the following slides are high. Well, we kept changing the title on this slide, and I didn't get the last revision. My apologies. And the following slides are the high-level view of the business case. So the HRIS business case accomplishments thus to date, hired a certified project manager, project charter was approved, steering committee was formed, project team with the LFO was formed, and consultants were hired to develop the business case and other deliverables. 12 vendors demonstrated systems just in an informational context. Survey of Enterprise Human Resource Shadow Systems was done, 46 resource and position control business processes mapped, 810 requirements have been defined. We've reviewed our lessons learned from past projects. We've consulted with Gartner and Deloitte on leading practices, and we surveyed agencies on greatest area need and readiness. Our quality assurance contractor's been hired. Our monthly briefings are occurring with LFO agency and IT analysts. Business case is widely reviewed, and our business case is submitted to my office for stage gate review and endorsement. We've established and followed a strong governance model. These are our success factors and strategy. We have established and follow a strong governance model. We've created our steering committees, advisory board, and change control board. We provide adequate project resources. We make change management a critical part of implementation solution, employing organizational change management services. Because this is ultimately about, this really isn't an IT project. I know we like to say all these things are IT projects. They're not. They're actually business projects. IT is simply supporting the change to the business process. The degree of fit, long-term support, expandability and flexibility, cost risk. What I'm giving you here is a high-level look at what the rubric will be for the analysis of solutions proposed. So that's really what this is. There's a rubric that we've got defined for how we're going to evaluate solutions as we go through the RFP process. There's more refinement to that needs to happen. So these are our summary of alternatives. We can do nothing. And estimated 10-year op costs is $80 million. Estimated total 14-year life cycle cost was $80 million. I was surprised by that. I thought that should be much higher. I don't know if we're counting on conjuring the spirits of those who maintain the system, but I'm not sure what that runs. Building custom HR applications to replace PPDD and PICS is $130 million over 15 years. Acquire a COTS HRIS solution, $81 million over 15 years. Acquire a COTS HRIS solution off-premise. Acquire a COTS HR SaaS solution housed in the cloud. These are all part of the business case. And you can see the shortest amount of time there is the SaaS solution there at 2 years to implement.
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Did you want to say it? No. So our alternative is we would prefer a COTS, either hosted or operated by a vendor as software as a service. The RFP will ask vendors to propose what implementation model would be best for Oregon. Our business process change, and then why, of course, our business process change required will need to be defined and articulated more fully. And that will be done by visiting, as we narrow solutions, one of the things we'll do is go to where it is that this is implemented to see how a state that has implemented that solution. But alternatively, one of the things that I've done in previous lives is bring people from that have the solution in process to come and see how we currently do business, just to both to gauge their shock factor and to get their insights into what they can warn us they think is going to change. No customization as per previous comment or concern expressed by Representative Parker. Only configuration, private or hybrid cloud environment is what we're looking at.
So I think steps. I'm supposed to do next steps, but a couple of, and this will be our last slide, and take some questions. Alex mentioned that we really are at a point now where we think we've done almost everything we can do internally as far as understanding what we think we need. What we really need to do now, since it's been a long time since we've done this, we need to get to the vendor community and figure out what's out there right now and how can we work through this. And And that's not just a technology interface. We also know that the world of finance regarding these systems has changed dramatically, too. And so we need to have some interface through an RFI process, probably with confidentiality agreements, to be able to interface with the vendor community, get more information. We intend to do that in January and February of next year. We'd like to finalize the RFP and release it in March. We'd like to have that on the street for a couple of months, be back in roughly May with a recommendation to you and obviously understanding the financials better by that time and make an ask before session is over regarding are we ready to fund this or not. Again, I want to emphasize kind of three areas of risk for us. First of all, of course, we've experienced the risk of implementing large IT projects. We know that there's a risk. But I would submit to you that for the entire project, the whole enchilada, if you will, of the 12 systems, we have two bigger risks. I think it's a bigger risk for us in the finance world. If we're going to come back to you every 2 to 4 years for $40 or $50 million, and that has to compete in the capital finance arena against all the other $2 billion worth of projects we have applications for in this budget, I would submit to you that I may be long gone, and all of us may be long gone, before we finish those 12 systems replacements from just a finance perspective. And that's not even the biggest risk. We've talked in multiple slides about what I consider to be our biggest risk, and that is we're going to buy off-the-shelf systems. We are not going to customize systems, which means you got to deal with human beings, and you got to change the way they do business, and you got to change the culture of those business processes. And for my money and my experience, that's the biggest risk. It always is. And so you've heard the term change management on multiple slides here. We have got to get more capacity regarding change management and our ability to do that. This project in the budget has change management in it, and we will certainly propose for the implementation of this project that we have specific change management talent and capacity to do this with human resources. And you saw the 46 business processes that have been mapped. They all have to be adjusted, right? But I would submit to you that this will just be an experience for us that tells us that we need broadly in state government a lot more capacity and talent regarding the issue of change management in a lot of our business processes. And that's where the enterprise architecture piece comes in and ties in. We need to understand our business to the level that we know when we're going to change something how to go about doing it. And that's really complicated stuff. And we don't have a lot of capacity to do that in state government right now. So, lot said there, but that's where I think the big risks lie for us in all of this core system replacement. And be happy to try and take some questions.
Senator Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate the work you've done on this and your thinking on it. And it, frankly, have great comfort in Alex's approach. I've listened to him since he's been here. It strikes me that you're on the right track. The four areas you talked about are really pretty standard business areas, and like everybody always likes to think they're different. The reality is, you know, a payroll system is a payroll system, a budgeting system is a budgeting system, and there are 50 or 49 other states out there and a lot of big corporations that have to do these same things. So I suspect that, Sarah, I don't want to presuppose your outcome, but to the extent that we can use other service bureaus or have somebody else house the and maintain the hardware, that strikes me as a smart thing to do. But again, I wait for your outcome on that. So I appreciate your – it seems like a very rigorous process, and you're asking the right questions, so thank you.
Thank you. This is a pretty big process. What's the plan for finance? How are we going to pay for it?
Well, currently, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, currently, as we have planned this so far, we will have a capital finance ask for this component. Again, after we go to the market, we learn more about kind of what are the financial tools available to us other than capital finance. That's one choice. I think kind of as you've seen the draft implementation plan, I'm sure that will get some amending once we've interfaced with the vendor community and have a better sense of timing and cost. But we intend to come back during session for this ATRIS component with our current knowledge and ask for a capital finance ask on it.
Are there any other options that would be available to fund?
Well, I think there are a number of options that have evolved in the vendor community over the last decade or so. Currently, you can get vendor-financed processes where they will do both the implementation and maintenance of it for you. Now, there are costs to that, and you have to weigh all of those things because they're not going to give you money for free. So we're going to have to think through those. But those kinds of other more innovative ways of financing these kinds of projects exist in the vendor community today. We haven't taken advantage of those. We may have one small roadblock that we may have to come back and talk with you about if that's a route we want to go in Chapter 283. I'm prohibited from signing a financial agreement without ownership of the asset. So if, in fact, we were going to do something that we were leasing and that was being supplied through the vendor, we may have difficulty entering into that kind of a financing agreement without statutory change. So we're still doing the analysis on that right now, but there'll be a number of choices when we come back.
This is really an important program that you're doing. Mm-hmm. When you come back to us, are you going to try to elevate it above other systems? And because it's really needed in our state, so will you try to move it to the top for financing and talk to the good chair and have him give you a couple points for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, currently it is at the top of our list of things to do regarding IT projects. There's no question.
Thank you.
Representative Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment. Thank you for getting this to this point. I've been here less time than I think anyone else up here, and I'm leaving before you all.
Smarter.
I'm a less slow learner than some others. I don't know. But, I mean, the conversation here in this room today is, I think, to my ears, nice, substantively different than just 6 years ago when I came in here. And I think it reflects a lot of pain and suffering and sweat, you know, on your part, as well as other folks in this room and some who have walked out of the room for a little bit. But my hat's off to you and all the others that are behind this. So thanks.
Mr. Chairman, and if I may at this point, just to reciprocate, Representative Harker, your attention to the details around this realm, this area of interest, has been incredibly helpful to us also. Some of the pieces of legislation you brought forward and we've either passed or have caused us to enter into dialogues about that has been incredibly helpful. So thank you. I know this is probably your last IT meeting.
Yeah,
so
I believe it is.
We really, really appreciate all the help you've given us.
Well, thanks. Thank you very much. I hope I have been helpful at least a little bit. Yeah. Thanks.
So does that mean that Rep. Harker gets a treat also?
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Every committee I've been in this week, and it just seems like every legislative days or every session, there are IT projects. And I was just on a task force for DMV customer improvement. So you're aware that, and it was highly recommended because of, you know, that one's being held together by duct tape and whatever. Right. I mean, you know, it's kind of a legacy system. How do these projects, these disparate projects, fit into your plan? How do you determine what gets priority?
Chairman Devlin, Representative Thatcher, I would say that they are being determined right now as we go through the expression and I guess the way that I've been doing it is in a combination of getting actual data, as we've done here with with the LSIP system, as well as simply the metrics around what the age and state of the systems are themselves. The DMV system is one of the oldest systems that we have in production today, and it has had a great deal of not that there are things that are internal support systems, there are systems that are external citizen facing systems. The DMV system is an external facing system. It would affect everyone that has a driver's license in the state, and as a consequence have an enormous amount of impact if it were not to be supported. Unfortunately, there are, when everything is a priority, nothing can be a priority. And so as we work, as I work with the agencies and try to understand better their priorities and needs, just as you do in meeting with the different leadership from the different agencies, is understanding where they are in time and space and what are the actual impacts, whether it's Captain Worthy's system with the message switch or the DMV modernization project, or with the ATRIS and all the legacy apps that the Department of Administrative Services support. There are a lot of needs, and making that triage is not going to be, there is no, from an IT standpoint, there is no single answer. They all need to be redone. So.
Mr. Chairman, also, if I may add, Representative Thatcher, as you well know, our agencies are all in at least slightly and sometimes radically different positions from a maturity perspective, from a size and capacity perspective, from a financing capacity perspective. And so if you were trying to compare the DMV replacement with ATRIS, from just a financing perspective, you have very different environments. If we're going to do ATRIS, we're going to spread that financing across, regardless of how we actually get the money, we will spread the payment for that system across all agencies, and it will be an other funds kind of thing. And but if it's DMV, you know, it's going to come out of the trust. And so there are very different kinds of financials on these projects, aside from the technical pieces and the age of the systems and those kinds of issues. So we've got a lot of variables in those equations to try and figure out priorities.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, we'll close that hearing and we'll go on to our final hearing for the day, an update from Cover Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Technology Transition. Ms. Miller.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. Today I'm here as the project director for the Oregon Health Authority on the MAGI Medicaid System Transfer Project. Tina Edlund, who was project director when we were last in front of you in September, has entered into retirement, and I've been promoted, and so I'm acting in that capacity here with you today. Today I'm going to provide two updates, first on the technology transition project and our work to implement the federal healthcare.gov solution for open enrollment and transitioning the use of those systems in maintenance and operation. And then I'm going to talk to you about the new project that we're entering into that I understand Representative Harker heard about in Health and Human Service yesterday. And so I have some more detailed information to provide to the committee about that work. So let's talk first about the technology transition project, which had two goals. First, we were to transition private plan coverage and advanced premium tax credits to healthcare.gov. So I'll remind you that the Cover Oregon Board made the decision in spring of 2014 to use the federal marketplace technology for its solution to be a supported state-based marketplace rather than to complete the health insurance exchange technology project. Open enrollment for plan year 2015 happened on November 15th. The federal marketplace came up for applications just before midnight Pacific time on November 15th. And Oregonians now apply for private health plans and associated tax credits at healthcare.gov. In fact, it's the only place where Oregonians can get the tax credits. As an Oregonian, it's my obligation to say to anyone who's listening, if you need private health care coverage for January 1st coverage, you have until next Monday to complete your application at healthcare.gov if you want tax credits in January. So 15 of the 16 original insurance carriers who provided plan choices on Cover Oregon in the last calendar year engaged in a relationship with the federal marketplace. HealthNet was the only Oregon plan to choose not to participate in the federal exchange that had a plan in Oregon before. In 2014, the Cover Oregon solution offered 102 total individual plans, and there's actually more choice, even with one less carrier on the federal marketplace. This year, 132 total individual plans are available for Oregonians to select coverage from. In addition, it's important for you to understand that the Oregon Health Authority has elected to be a determination state for Medicaid applications that come in through healthcare.gov. And so what that means is the health authority accepts the decision made by the federal marketplace and provides coverage based on that decision for Medicaid applicants who come in through that door. So let's talk a little bit about what open enrollment go live was like. In order to support those activities, we established a cross-agency command center that had representatives of Cover Oregon and OHA leadership, the call centers, the application processing centers, people from the IT organizations, communication professionals. We worked in a on-site way for the first 5 days of open enrollment, running about 18 hours a day clock. It was on-site operations, not quite 24 hours a day. Then we, when we had need to stop, we didn't need to be on-site altogether working in a single war room. We transitioned to 3 times-a-day check-ins, 2 times-a-day check-ins. This being the fourth week of open enrollment, we've gone to 1 time-a-day check-in. And so still, 4 weeks into open enrollment, we're having regular leadership-level conversations about issues that are being raised in any part of the process. This methodology and the rigor that we've applied to this methodology has allowed us to figure out problems fast, to get those triaged and worked by making decisions that allow us to implement changes as fast as possible and to coordinate with our federal partners in places where we need to be making requests with them. The second goal of the technology transition project was to streamline Magi Medicaid application, right? So the first way that we streamline is the use of healthcare.gov for anyone who goes there to apply for private coverage or for Medicaid. Those folks, if they complete all of the fields in the application, for the most part, are getting a real-time eligibility determination. So you know at the completion of your application at the federal marketplace whether or not you qualify for Medicaid coverage in this state. But federal law actually requires OHA to have its own front door, right? We can't cede as our Medicaid program's responsibility that the only channel for electronic submission is to the federal place. So the second part of the original project was to bring back the OHA front door from Cover Oregon to the Oregon Health Authority. And we had intended to utilize the Oracle system originally to do that. When I was last in front of you, we were talking about sort of the relationship of the multiple websites, right? So healthcare.gov is the place where you can go to direct that the feds have. But then we implemented inside of Oregon a website we call OregonHealthcare.gov, which has a number of screening questions which help Oregonians know which door they can better be served by. There are lots of Oregonians who are best served at the federal marketplace because if they come from a mixed family where the parents might be eligible for private insurance, but the children are eligible for Medicaid, if they make that application at the federal level, the whole family can be served, right? If they make that application at the Oregon Health Authority, the parents have to then go back to the federal marketplace to get private insurance, even though the children can be covered. And so the screening questions on OregonHealthcare.gov are designed to direct people to the place where they can best get service. So we did it. You'll be happy to know that on the Sunday after November 15th, there were no articles in major news media outlets reporting about issues associated with open enrollment. That's a critical success factor for me in the work that we did. You know, we have been in close collaboration with our federal partners. All of our 15 carriers are getting actual enrollments in private plans direct from the federal marketplace. Those happen in a technology solution we call an 834 transaction, and so all of our plans are getting that information direct. But the Cover Oregon system, it's important for people to understand that for the next year, it actually still has to operate as the local Magi front door, right? We put up an online application that requires the Cover Oregon system to make a Medicaid determination locally. And so what we need to do, because you all are going to entertain a bill in the next session that has to do with the future of the legal entity Cover Oregon, we need to transition responsibility for that system to the Oregon Health Authority until the new project will replace that front door. And so the project has been working with OHA's IT shop, we call it OIS, to transition responsibility for maintenance and operations of that Cover Oregon system for its use in Medicaid determinations. And we are under advice of Alex Pettit, the state CIO, and your legislative IT staffers, Mr. Cummings. We are closing out the technology transition project and really initiating the system transfer system project as a new thing, right? So that we will go through all of the appropriate stage gate and oversight perspectives on the new initiative, separate and aside, because it's a radical departure from the previous project approach. And so our QA, independent QA vendor on the technology transition project, Maximus, will produce as its final deliverable a sort of closeout report on the project. So I can stop there and answer some questions before we talk about the new project, or I can keep going and take questions at the end. What's the preference of the committee?
Keep going.
Okay.
One quick question. Harper, thanks.
Yeah. Please.
And if you would prefer to defer,
sure.
The other part is just fine with me and probably everyone else. I'm concerned. What are the definitions about the requirements of what we have to stand up? What are the minimal requirements? Because we have to have a front door. We have to have a portal. All kinds of ways exist to deliver that functionality. And beyond that little doorway we pass through is where
sure.
The demons lie.
Yeah.
Right?
Chair Devlin, Representative Harker, I'd like to take an initial stab now, and then if you'd like to have more conversation after I talk about the new project,
okay.
I'm happy to mm-hmm. readdress it. So I think that the federal policy requirement is state Medicaid programs have to be able to accept online a Medicaid application It's another channel, just like paper applications are a channel, fax applications are a channel. We have to be able to accept online applications locally. So that's the piece that you reference when you say it has to have a little online
mm-hmm.
portal. The
mm-hmm.
problem is, in lots of states, they put a online portal on top of an existing legacy system where all their Medicaid determinations were done, and this is just a new channel into that system. In Oregon, we don't have that legacy system for Medicaid because when the health insurance exchange was created, the belief was that the new Oracle system would become that underlying system for Medicaid eligibility and enrollment. And so in the absence of a successful implementation of that solution, we can't just put a portal on the front end. So the new project is designed to be both the self-service portal that Oregon consumers would interact with. It will be the caseworker portal for staff who have to do certain tasks associated with applications if they can't be done start to finish in an automated way. And it will be the place we call case maintenance, so that if you get married, if you change jobs, if you have a change in circumstance that might affect your Medicaid eligibility benefits, you would be able to go to that system and make that change, either by yourself through the portal or by being in contact with a caseworker who can make the change on the back end of the system. And so the Oregon Health Authority finds itself in a position where we can't just implement a portal. We need a system that will do all three of those component pieces together. And that's the project that we are and entering into for system transfer. Does that make sense to sort of help?
That's a perfect place for us to continue your presentation and maybe our conversation later.
Sure.
Thank you.
So one of the things that I understood was topic of conversation in yesterday's committee is how do we get to the place where we decided to have a system transfer be the go forward? Because when I was in front of you in September, we were in the middle of what we called a technical architecture simplification review. So at the direction of Alex Pettit, the state CIO, he asked the Oregon Health Authority to look at the Oracle framework and use standardized criteria to evaluate whether that framework could meet business need in the future, right? When you're in the middle of trying to recover a troubled project and you're trying to figure out whether it makes more money to sink time and effort into fixing what is broken, you wanna know that it will meet your business need in the future. So we completed that review. The criteria on the screen are the things that we evaluated, the different kinds of functionality in the Oracle stack against. And so from a business capability perspective, these are the criteria that we evaluated, but then we looked at business eligibility, enrollment, case maintenance, the portal functions, business intelligence, which is what we call sort of reporting and analytics, document management, notices, so how we communicate with our customers, and then business automation, right? The way that we take information that customers give us, give it to workers, so that then we can make decisions in the future. In each case, the technical architecture simplification review judged the business functionality and use of the Oracle product against these standards. And in most cases, the Oracle product was a low or at best a medium fit for us around those business capabilities. And so the deal right in the original use of the framework was it wasn't designed just for Magi Medicaid. We had intention to use it for other health and human services and the eligibility determination for those programs. And so we were able to consider the needs of those programs in this evaluation, but it ends up being not a good fit. So you'll remember that Tina Edlund in the governor's office convened, we called it an interagency advisory committee, right? So it had the agency heads of the two agencies, plus Alex as the state CIO, the CIO of OHA and DHS. And together they took the results of this report and what we had been experiencing in our relationship with our former professional service provider and said, it doesn't make sense to stay on this path. We can continue to dump time, energy, and resource into this effort and not be guaranteed that we could deliver a success. And so a recommendation was made to abandon the Oracle technology stack. And once you make that decision, then, I mean, you've heard two presenters before me say, the lowest risk way to implement a technology solution is to transfer another state's solution. In the case of Magi Medicaid, Magi Medicaid is Magi Medicaid is Magi Medicaid for like well north of 80% of the business, right? States have individual options where they can make individual decisions about eligibility levels, but the basic functionality for medical benefits associated with income is the same. And so it made a lot of sense to us in our conversations with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, our federal funding partner, that you would look at systems that are in production and say, somebody's already done it. Could we please just take their system and make the fewest changes possible to implement it here? And so we made that choice as the lowest risk go forward approach. And then the Oregon Health Authority undertook an evaluation process to determine whose system fit the best. We looked at eight states, and those eight states came to us because CMS said, hey, these are good models. We want you to look at them. Our system integrator said, hey, these are models we think can meet your business need. We want you to look at them. And so then we built a evaluation matrix that first considered the state's fit from a Medicaid policy perspective, right? You make system transfer projects work by matching up business process, right? You don't make system transfer projects work by changing the technology you bring from another state. So we looked across these eight and said, which ones are we the closest like? And Judy Moore Peterson, the business lead on my project, state Medicaid director, would say, if you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program, which means, you know, all of them are different. But from a basic system functionality perspective, it was really easy for us to narrow this list of eight down to three that would most closely fit Oregon's business needs. So we looked at system level demonstrations of Rhode Island, Kentucky, and Arizona. And then when we're at the demonstration level or talking to their technical staff level, we looked at much deeper level of specific functionality. What was the ease of use of the portal, and had it been usability tested, because that is important. What was the ease of use of the caseworker interface to the system? We just had done all this work on identifying technical architecture criteria, so we used those criteria to evaluate transfer systems and said if those things mattered to us in the past, we need to make sure that they line up for the future system that we considered. We looked at documentation of transfer systems, right? In state government IT projects, we are notoriously bad for not documenting systems appropriately. And when you take a system transfer project, you need to have really robust documentation so that you understand how the system is built and how you can operate it once it comes. So we made judgments on that. And then we even looked at how long does it take the other state to remediate defects and implement enhancements, because we use that as a measure to help us understand how complexly built the system is and what level of customization exists. I listened to your conversation about configuration versus customization with keen ear. This was an attempt of us to try and get a sense of that initially in our evaluation. So at the end of looking at those three systems in much greater detail, we recommended, and Tina Edlin ultimately supported, the choice of the Kentucky system, which they call Kinect. So this is a screenshot for the Kentucky system. It has several highlights that are important for folks to understand. So this might surprise you, but we actually in Oregon are very much like Kentucky in general demographics of the state population as a whole and demographics of the Medicaid population. So this system was used to enroll more than 600,000 people in their Medicaid expansion since October of 2013. It's been in production. Its user interface is adapted to a sixth grade reading level, which helps meet our standard to outreach to consumers in the Medicaid population. It has an anonymous sort of pre-screening functionality, so if you don't want to do everything to set up an account, you can go in and enter some basic demographic information, and the system will tell you what programs you might be eligible for, so you can make an informed choice about application before you create the account. It does real-time eligibility determination, so that thing we were saying that best serves Oregonians by going to the federal marketplace, that will be the case for us here. And then they have managed care in Kentucky, which is, you know, sort of the equivalent model for us of coordinated care organizations. And so we would use that same system functionality to enroll Oregonians in CCOs here. It automates change of circumstance and renewal. And it comes with gigabytes, I am not kidding, gigabytes of system documentation. And so it is extremely robustly documented. I don't want to represent to you that, you know, we can just lift and drop it and, you know, take off Kentucky as a logo and put on Oregon Health Authority as a logo and make it run. There is actual development work that has to happen. Much of the work that has to happen is integration into our existing systems, right? So we have an interface with MMIS. That's the claims payment system. Now, it helps that in Kentucky, the vendor for MMIS is HP. In Oregon, the vendor for MMIS is HP. And so the interface foundations are there, but they have to be customized to our particular implementation. It's also important for you to understand that Kentucky is a state-based marketplace, so it doesn't have a connection to the federal marketplace in terms of passing non-Medicaid eligibles to the federal marketplace for QHP, and so we'll have to build that interface on our own. But outside of that and some particular enterprise-level services that Kentucky utilized, this system comes ready to implement with very few customizations. So what have we done so far? I told you we're treating this as a brand new project, which means according to the stage gate process, we completed a business case and received a conditional IRR approval from Mr. Pettit. We will continue to meet those conditions as we go through subsequent stages by providing updated information along the way. There was a lot of conversation about our use of an advisory group in the previous flavor of the project compared to a steering committee that had governance authority. Mm-hmm. And so the Oregon Health Authority has convened the oversight body as an actual steering committee authorized by and reports to the director of the Oregon Health Authority. The project sponsor is Linda Hammond, who is acting COO at the Oregon Health Authority. And she's the project sponsor. You might expect, say, Judy Moore Peterson as the state Medicaid director to be the project sponsor of an eligibility system. But she's actually business lead on the project. And so by having her act as a key project member, we are able to make decisions on a day-to-day basis that allow us flexibility in terms of making policy changes or business process changes necessary to not modify the technology. And so Linda Hammond is the sponsor. We executed a contract amendment with our system integration vendor to do a fit gap of the Kentucky solution. So we're taking all of the requirements of the initial implementation of Kentucky, and we're reviewing them by functional area to confirm that, yes, we can use the system as it's defined or identify where there are gaps. Once we identify the subset that are gaps, we're going through a process to try and resolve that gap in a non-technology way. Can we modify a policy? Can we implement a new business process? Can we make some other kind of organizational change that allows us to make a workaround to not have to adjust the technology? And then at last, if we have to make technical modifications, we do that. And we're doing that for both functional requirements, those are associated with the business of use of the system, and for technical requirements and non-functional requirements associated with the back end architecture and how that system relates to other systems. And so next steps, right, between now and February 15th, we will complete our fit gap. And, you know, I talked a little bit about our goal is to minimize to the greatest extent possible changes to the system. We actually have to sign an interstate agreement with Kentucky to allow the transfer to happen. Mm-hmm. So for the record, right, Kentucky makes no money on giving us the system. There is no payment for the code that transfers. The work of the project will be minimizing the modifications that have to be made and paying to do the new development associated with interfaces. We're talking to Kentucky about a shared governance model that would have us both be making enhancements to the system, which would lower both sides' total cost because we can do that code exchange multiple times along the maintenance and operations life of the project. We are going to hire a third-party QA vendor using the Enterprise Master Agreement for the new project. And so we're going through that process with the Office of the State CIO. And we're, you know, continuing to follow their stage gate process to proceed towards implementation. Our objective is to enter into an implementation contract with our system integration vendor starting by February 15th for a fourth quarter 2015 implementation. And with that, I'm happy to talk about whatever you'd like.
Questions? Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the exchange, not the...
Sure.
I'm trying to remember this, but I think it was yesterday there was a media report that we were, with just a few days left, only 9% of re-enrollments. What's your projection on that?
Chair Devlin, Senator Byer, in all truth, right, I'm the resident technologist who sits between the business and the IT solution. That question is better directed to Aaron Patnode, the executive director for Cover Oregon. I know that they have actively engaged in an outreach campaign to make sure that people who purchase plans on the exchange know that they have to take action. And they are doing active outreach to make sure that people who purchased off exchange consider purchasing on exchange in the future. But I can't comment on the projections for enrollment. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so are you? I'm done. With Representative Parker.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, follow-up answer. Not to put words in Mr. Patnode's mouth, but I believe they're expecting a big ramp as we get toward the closer and closer to the deadline, as is not too surprising. It's kind of like my Christmas shopping.
Yeah,
you know.
But, yeah, I finished my open enrollment for state benefits on the last day of open enrollment as an educated state employee. So yeah. December 15th, there may be tens of thousands of enrollments.
Question?
No, I think it's
even though it's problematic what the level of enrollment has been, it may even be problematic if it doesn't get to the levels that they have indicated. I think it's also good to keep in mind that what we're talking about is people going through the process to get the tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that there are not people out there with their own insurance policy that are not pursuing the tax
for
credit,
sure,
that are not going through the system, mm-hmm, or obviously the people that we have with employer-provided systems that
for
are not
sure
public that are still in the system. So, additional questions? Yes, Representative Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following on my compliments from the previous panel here, I think this is a sensible approach going forward. And given that Dr. Pettit is in the position he is in and has the responsibility, the authority and the responsibility for helping to navigate mm-hmm this, I have more confidence that we're going to get, we're mm-hmm going to come out in a sunny place. I have some special concerns because we're talking about dealing with another state as the code writer. And as you said, they're not making any money off it, which means, based on my experience in co-developing software with a state entity, not from Kentucky, but from a nearby state, we will have only limited ability to drive their responses to whatever we encounter, unless we co-own that code
mm-hmm
and can do what we need to with it. And I got a little more anxious when you talked about co-development and code sharing and a single repository about the issues that play out in that kind of scenario. And I'll just say, I really hope this gets managed tightly and carefully.
Chair Devlin, Representative Harker, two things. I should clarify for the record, Kentucky did not do development of KyNect. Kentucky engaged Deloitte Consulting to do development of KyNect, so it is not developed or even yet maintained and operated by state employees in Kentucky. So I left you with the wrong impression by saying that. The piece about the interstate agreement mm-hmm is because the Kentucky Health and Human Service Cabinet, which is the agency in which the Kentucky Health Benefits Exchange exists, was the recipient of federal funding dollars that were utilized to pay Deloitte to do that work.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do the agreement with Kentucky to transfer their system. But it's not a shared development with a state-implemented system, number one. Number two, we're just having conversations about shared governance. We have not entered into agreement. I was using those examples as things that we are talking to Kentucky about the potential use of in terms of the kinds of things you could, on a shared governance agreement, you could go all the way from a single code repository that two sides check stuff into, or you could be at the end of the spectrum that is, we do requirements development work for Medicaid system enhancements together and both reap the benefit of only having to do that once for future enhancements. So along that continuum, there are lots of choices in between, and we are having weekly dialogues with Kentucky about what their level of tolerance is to partner with us mm-hmm up that chain. What I can tell you is our federal funding partners are very interested in it, and you all probably know better than anybody else based on the number of large double-digit million-dollar IT projects that you're asked to fund. The feds are saying we have to stop paying for the same thing over and over and over again in 50 states. There have to be ways to get economies of scale. And so I think our federal funding partners are saying, yes, transfer, super excited about you getting a system that actually works somewhere else, but we'd really like you as part of that work to talk about if that system could benefit from enhancement work you're doing in reverse. And when we're on that continuum, you know, it's a dialogue. So no agreements have been made. I take your point very seriously about the level of rigor that you have to apply to a shared governance model. And we'll certainly be prepared to be transparent about that with all of you in the future.
Thanks.
Any additional? Thank you very much.
Happy to be here.
That concludes our meeting for today, so we are recessed.
until the special session. For today, so we are recessed until the special session.